Hi, I'm Jennifer Elrod. I'm a judge on the Fifth Circuit. And I am delighted to be hosting this panel, Conservative Public Interest Litigation in the Modern Era. Some of you may be saying, what is conservative public interest litigation? I'm sure our learned panelists will explain that for us. A number of organizations have engaged in litigation against what they perceive as regulatory abuse and overreach in the last three decades. Professor Murray has even written a book, By the People, calling for a Madison Fund to expand the fight against the regulatory state. At issue is whether the election of a deregulatory-leaning administration moots these efforts, or is there still more work to be done? Will some states take on the regulatory mantle, and so the litigation will move into state courts? And also, one other issue that we're going to talk about for you law students in the room is, can you actually make a living as a conservative public interest lawyer? Stay tuned, you might learn about that as well. Very pleased to have a very learned panel today. First, we have Professor Michael Grieva. Professor Grieva joined the faculty of the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University. Don't you like to say that? The Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University, I like to say that. In the fall of 2012, after having served as the John G. Searle Scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, where he specialized in constitutional law, courts, and business regulation, and served as the chairman of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He is a prolific writer, author of 9 books and a multitude of articles, and he has provided congressional and state legislative testimony, has lobbied and consulted in federal agency proceedings, and has provided litigation services in over 30 cases, including matters before the Supreme Court. Welcome, Professor Grieva. You can clap. Our next speaker today is Kate Todd. Kate Todd is the former senior vice president and chief counsel for the U.S. Chamber Litigation Center, which is the litigation arm of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. She has a broad range of government and private sector experience, with particular expertise in federal appellate practice and constitutional law. She has worked in the White House. She has been a partner in appellate litigation and communications practice of a prominent law firm, and she has clerked for the Associate Justice Clarence Thomas. And she also served as the executive editor of Harvard Law Review. You've heard of that. She received her undergraduate degree in government, history, and international relations from Cornell, and she lives in Virginia, and we're very happy to have Kate and her expertise on our panel today. Our next panelist is Ted Frank, senior attorney and director of the Center for Class Action Fairness. Before it merged with CEI in October 2015, he founded and ran CCAF as a nonprofit public interest law firm in 2009. He's won landmark appeals and lots of money for consumers and other plaintiffs through his class action work. He has been called the leading critic of abusive class action settlements, and the American Lawyer Litigation Daily referred to him as the indefatigable scourge of underwhelming class action settlements. I like that word, indefatigable. Ted clerked for the Honorable Frank H. Easterbrook for the Seventh Circuit and was a litigator for 10 years until he won a sizable windfall in the World Series of Poker. That's a topic for another day, but definitely a topic. He's a frequent public speaker, and he's testified before Congress many times. We're very grateful to have Ted here to illumine us. Thank you. And last, but certainly not least, is Mr. Mark Smith. Mark is familiar with all aspects of conservative public interest litigation, having advised clients and donors in a broad range of matters from high-profile litigations to confidential representations. Only months after he started practicing law, Mark and his clients were the subject of a New York Times article discussing their case, which raised a constitutional challenge to an economic regulation. A mere 3 months later, Mark appeared again in the New York Times, except this time on a cover story about he, as co-counsel, set a jury trial record for the largest jury verdict ever against a New York City co-op building for race discrimination. Since then, he has litigated cases involving billions of dollars, including trying the largest no-fault trial in American history for tens of millions of dollars against over 50 insurance companies. Most recently, he served as the media surrogate for the Donald Trump for President campaign and also served on the president's transition team. Please welcome Mark Smith. Our panelists are each going to give a few remarks. Then we will have some interaction between the panelists. And then, as always, we will take questions from the audience, and I may ask a few questions too. Thank you.
We do the sitting down, right? Thanks, Judge, for the generous introduction. Thanks to the Federalist Society for inviting me. I actually used to do public interest litigation, but that was in the pre-modern era, and I'm sort of speaking more or less as sort of an observer of the scenery, so I have a few remarks on what I think has changed in public interest litigation over the decades, and how sort of it fits into the broader framework of conservative libertarian politics. The model we used to have back then, the 90s, the playbook which we had inherited from the left was to discredit institutions and to sort of amp up the volume of public debate, right? So think of the affirmative action cases against universities. Right, these places were run by overpaid cowards who sort of stifled any kind of debate about their projects and their policies under a cone of silence. We had to take these people down, no regrets. In some areas, that is still, it seems to me, has to be the agenda. So the higher ed, OCR, sexual harassment cartel, which, you know, the ed blob will, you know, continue with or without OCR. That's a fine example. I say go out there, litigate against these people. That's a stable job because university administrators cannot be shamed. But I think in other domains, we may want to entertain a somewhat different thought. Just which institution do you think we can still discredit that hasn't already done that all by itself? And I wonder how much more you can sort of amp up the volume on public debate beyond sort of Ingram After Dark or whatever these programs are called. So we've always, it seems to me, stood for reasoned constitutional politics. We've rejected political nihilism. We have rejected incendiary diatribes and stood for reasoned debate, and I think we should continue to do that, and maybe consistent with that program, we have to find ways of re-legitimizing political institutions or public institutions and sort of generate a debate that's actually worth having. How do you do that? Well, for one thing, you can staff government agencies with people who are committed to lawful government, to effective government, and to communicating their agency's mission with a great deal of plausibility, and incredibly, that's happening. Our anti-administrativist friends are, in fact, re-legitimizing the instruments of lawful, proficient government quite deliberately. And, you know, we have people like that and an intellectual reservoir on which they can build because of patient work and effort over decades and decades, much of it, most of it actually, procured under the Federalist Society's umbrella and penumbra. And but for that investment of effort and thought, and reasoned debate, this country might by now be Venezuela. What can public interest law contribute to this accomplishment? I want to save sort of more tactical questions about how do you litigate it under conditions where the agencies basically are copacetic. I want to save that for Q&A and just say a few words on some broader questions. Litigation always looks adversarial and in your face, right? So you wonder how can that contribute to legitimating institutions and reasoned debate. In lots of ways, actually, and to sort of just give you a few examples, right? Ted Frank has sort of won cases where missing half inch of a Subway sandwich is worth several million dollars to the lawyers on each side. The Institute for Justice has litigated hundreds of these hair braiding licensing cases and won most. Pacific Legal has successfully litigated cases like Zacket where you need a permit and you never get it, and the permitting requirements effectively destroy the value of your property. There are lots and lots of examples like that. And what I think they illustrate is the somewhat ambivalent nature of litigation, right? Of course you want to take the bastards down, that's the point. But you also want to sort of recenter a public debate, and what the examples I just gave you have in common is that they involve adjudication rather than sort of pre-enforcement review of gargantuan agency rulemakings, right? That is always going to be sort of an interest group sport. We had to do those cases during the Obama administration, but the debate around those things always disintegrates, I think, quickly into abstractions or sort of hopeless confusion. It's much easier to have a reasonable debate about the question of whether this agency can do that to you in particular. And there's some evidence, I think, that focus has already helped to reorient the academic debate and reform public institutions in a good way. My main worry in terms of sort of re-legitimizing institutions and promoting a less sort of incendiary debate is actually about something a little bit different. It's about religion and culture. We used to have a Lockean consensus in this country, which among other things said that we will not weaponize the administrative state and go to war against religion. That consensus has collapsed, that is over, and so now you see organizations defending religious freedom sort of on the grounds that, no, wait a minute, the Little Sisters of the Poor need an exemption, or wait a minute, I'm not a baker, I'm actually an artist. Why is it so hard in that context to sort of make litigation work to re-legitimate institutions, to reground public debate? To my mind, the right not to deal is the foundation of a free society, and that's true whether you're an artist or a baker and whether you're religious or not. You want to re-legitimate that principle and that institution of a free society before you obsess over Chevron's metaphysics. But we don't have quite the nerve to say that and to re-legitimate the institutions that sort of spring from spontaneous natural order, and I think going forward that's the biggest challenge we face.
Thank you very much. Kate, do you have some thoughts?
Thank you, Judge Elrod, and a particular pleasure. It's a particular pleasure to be on a panel with you, one of the bright spots in those last dark days of the Bush administration trying to get judicial nominations through. I spend much of my time at these conventions seeing the faces of those who didn't make it and the judiciary that might have been. So thank you for your service. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for your service in helping me.
Thank you. First, I'll start with some disclaimers. I am not here on behalf of the U.S. Chamber or speaking for the U.S. Chamber, nor am I privy to any of the details, really, of the current strategic agenda of the Litigation Center. Nor, of course, do I think that one should equate the business community public interest agenda with the conservative public interest agenda necessarily. But certainly during the Obama administration years, and particularly in the waning days of the administration, I think the agenda for the business community very significantly overlapped and had some pretty high synergies with the conservative public interest litigation agenda. where you have just absolutely outrageous overregulation, you tend to have a lot of groups that come together, and nothing quite brings everybody together in litigation or otherwise, like that sort of determined enemy that I think so many saw in the Obama administration. I'm not going to go back as far as to the 90s. I just want to go back to the election last year and say, at least from looking at it from the business community perspective, on Election Day and before Election Day, certainly the U.S. Chamber itself had about 24 pending pieces of litigation across a whole slew of subjects, a whole, a hodgepodge of administrative agencies. And the regulations were terrible, and they were so deliciously terrible as a litigator that they were really dream targets in a lot of ways. And I think it's worth remembering. Remember, it's the EPA's Clean Power Plan that generated the unprecedented stay out of the Supreme Court, where the D.C. Circuit wouldn't do that job, one of the last acts of Justice Scalia judicially. And it was also really the overreach of the Obama administration that I think really got numerous Supreme Court justices, those that weren't necessarily already headed that direction, to really rethink some foundational principles of administrative law and the deference issue. So, in that respect, I guess we do have the last administration to thank for getting us all to focus on these very important topics, and maybe Richard Cordray for making it sexy again to talk about Humphrey's executor. The challenges then were really a combination of, one, sort of triaging the regulatory overreach and garnering the resources to fight so many battles on so many fronts, recognizing that the president had really succeeded in doing some pretty substantial shifts within the federal judiciary, and making that question and the strategic call as to where to file, where you could find a venue that you would have some openness to hearing challenges to centerpiece regulatory litigation, legislation or regulation, was really a central part of our litigation strategy. And then, of course, you're always struggling with the questions anybody has when you're filing a big lawsuit, whether to seek preliminary injunctions, and really struggling with the legitimacy and desirability of seeking nationwide stays, which look a little bit different today than they did at the time, and all the while trying to maintain peace among coalitions that were really very varied groups with a lot of different interests and a lot of different ways of trying to approach any particular piece of litigation. So there's lots to do. I think there were a tremendous number of righteous arguments, and there was some good recognition, at least at the top, at the Supreme Court, that there was a regulatory train going off the rails. But there was also the prospect at that time that the judiciary wasn't going to get any better. So good arguments, but you were probably going to lose. So enter the election. You all know what happened. And I think it's worth talking about this sort of interim period, because I don't think the real shift into the modern era has necessarily fully happened just yet. And I'll insert a particular note on public interest litigation as an advocacy tool. For anyone who has been on the business end of public interest litigation, there are some very important and critical rules for suing, a lot of boxes you have to check in terms of your justiciability issues, but also high among them is the rule that you need to get your money, your financing, your fundraising done up front before you file the complaint. And that's because litigation takes a heck of a long time. It's very unpredictable. It takes twists and turns. People aren't quite expecting. You can't generally shift or turn on a dime in your strategy the way that you might be able to in a sort of lobbying approach. So it's powerful, highly effective, but not the most nimble of tools in the advocacy arsenal. And this can be frustrating to those whose primary advocacy tools aren't litigation. And I think you had a lot, and you continue to have a lot of groups that are trying to fight on a lot of different fronts. And so why does this all matter? I think it's because there was a lot of euphoria after the election, and perhaps justified to some degree substantively about where regulations would end up. But not necessarily always appreciating not just the amount of time it takes to turn the ship as a regulatory matter, but also how difficult it can be to untangle and unwind litigation. So where there were stays in place, of course, this was great. It kept the pressure on to do something, but gave some breathing room to the new administration. But it was still litigation over which there was not complete control by the government or the petitioners. I know certainly from where we sat at the chamber, you know, one of the hardest things in our litigation was trying to find new personnel on the other end of the phone to talk to about the litigation. It takes time to put people in. It has an effect on some of the interim types of logistics and scheduling and stays and et cetera in the litigation. Also, of course, continue to be entrenched pressures within the agencies trying to convince the newcomers that the institutional interests outweighed whatever the policy initiatives were going to be, and there was the CFPB, which did whatever the hell it wanted to do. So, you know, all the while, you had new fuel, new life, new energy put into all of the other advocacy tools. And so everybody else who had for a very long time, although we all thought of litigation as a last resort, it was a last resort we were running to time and time again because it was all we had. You know, there's sort of a little bit of a feeling, not to denigrate the types of litigation that was brought, but that it's starting to feel a little stale because there's a lot of other games going on in town. And so that's why I mentioned that whole money piece and making sure people understand, like, once you file litigation, you're in it for a long haul until it really gets resolved, and it's just a reality of the litigation tool. So I'll just say a few brief comments on the modern era and what I see sort of ahead. And for the business community, I think it's pretty simple, and I think it's some of what Judge Elrod sort of foreshadowed in her introduction. You know, it's most likely that we will see a shift away from having a lot of affirmative federal regulatory challenges brought. You will see a shift to having the business community appear much more as an intervener or as an amicus. You saw that in you know, bucking up deregulatory executive orders, for example. It's nice to be defending for a change, but it also means that we might be, or the business community might be, much more frequently in venues not of their choosing. So I think you're going to see a further development of administrative law in circuits where certainly had the business community been filing first, they wouldn't have chosen. Of course, the business community has been known to challenge Republican administrations. I think there's a little bit of a higher perceived cost to going into the courtroom when it's folks that you otherwise think are going to be doing some good things for you across other fronts. So I think, you know, while obviously if you just look at policy issues and not current litigation, you see NAFTA, immigration as both possible areas where you could have suits. The third thing also mentioned, you know, was that I think you'll see a shift to state and local. You've already seen that a little bit. The activism will just move to a different place. It's much more dispersed. It's much harder to get your arms around. And finally, I could imagine that with the current administration's agenda that, you know, certainly companies will individually feel more compelled to get involved in even more social issues than they've dipped their toes into in the last few years, and there might be some additional pressure to push business groups outside of what I consider the traditional business role into some of those issues. And finally, I just want to put a few ideas on the table that I think are challenges more broadly for the conservative public interest beyond the business community. I am not normally a very Pollyannish person, but I'm very optimistic about this moment. I think the combination of the administration's agenda, the judicial nominees in the pipeline, the judicial nominees who've already been confirmed, and the sort of focus on the administrative state right now is where the rubber meets the road. And I'm very, very hopeful that we'll move beyond sort of nipping around the edges and sort of using the palliative APA to striking more structural blows at the administrative state. But I do think that the challenge, the biggest challenge in this modern era may be that each conservative group has to really figure out what its ultimate true aim is. And it's much easier to fight something when the policy principles and constitutional underpinnings all are badly done, and you can say, that's bad, we need to take it down. And it's much, much more difficult to separate out when perhaps the policies and the principles and the underlying constitutional issues aren't all pointing in the same direction. And we can sort of chuckle at the left's newfound embrace of federalism, but it's something that conservative groups are going to have to embrace. And they're going to have to embrace what they care about in policies and what they care about it on methodology. And I think that's really one of the big challenges going forward. You're not going to see big coalitions. You're going to see a lot more focused strategic litigation, and you should figure out which group it is whose mission you most want to support and get behind them no matter what they have to fight through.
Thank you. Thank you, Kate. Ted?
Okay. Thank you. It's a privilege and an honor, of course, to speak at the Federalist Society with so many amazing panelists and speakers, and it's a real privilege to have such a full room here when there are so many competing events at this time slot. I'd like to talk about the idea of forming a conservative public interest litigation group and what I've done to do that and what we'll be doing at the Competitive Enterprise Institute with that. And when I started the Center for Class Action Fairness in 2009, it was a question of looking for a niche that there wasn't anybody doing what we were doing, but the incentives needed to be there to move the law in the right direction. But at the same time, do this with a couple of animating principles behind it, and one I think was very important, and Kate sort of alluded to, is being able to show bang for the buck to donors. You can't do this without money behind it, and donors have all sorts of opportunities to be giving money to all sorts of really good causes, and you have to be able to show them that what they're giving money for, you're going to stretch that dollar as much as you can and accomplish as much as you can with it, and really work on that, and that means in terms of triaging what sort of cases you're taking, finding the cases that can create the most precedent, that will have the most impact, thinking ahead at the case selection, not what an individual result will be, but you know what is the time commitment versus what are the potential impacts? Is there a cert petition that you can think of 3 years down the road, win or lose? And part of that, it was also the second animating feature, which is, you know, sort of create a dream job for attorneys working with you. And I think that's important on the bang for the buck metric, because you really have to moneyball it. You really have to find attorneys who are willing to take the sacrifice, take the pay cut to do conservative public interest litigation. They're giving up a lot of money to do that instead of working at a large law firm. And the problem is, of course, when you're doing conservative public interest litigation is that the attorneys willing to do it are perfectly happy being in an environment where they're making money and defending people that can afford to pay big law prices. So you have to offer some sort of alternative that makes it worthwhile for them, and so we created an atmosphere where people could work from home and have a work-life balance. We have my number two and number three attorneys are both stay-at-home moms with four and three kids respectively. And then, you know, give them autonomy and opportunities that they wouldn't have at a big law firm. So, you know, we have this big docket, and people are working maybe as hard as they are at big law, not putting in the hours, but, you know, intensity of what they're doing. But we've had four different attorneys getting to argue appeals, and We have a giant docket of a couple of dozen cases, including a dozen appeals pending at any time, And that gives them just real opportunities, and because of that, we get really good attorneys working for us. And so it was exciting to be able to take this program and merge it into the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And it's what Michael Grieve calls its anti-administrative project that Jillian Metzger was talking about in the previous panel in her recent Harvard Law Review article. CEI, of course, had the Free Enterprise Fund case and King versus Burwell. And we're looking forward to sort of expanding what we're doing, the model we had at the Center for Class Action Fairness to tackling the regulatory state at CEI. And I think there's some interesting opportunities there. In particular, the regulatory state and its use of the litigation process to sort of accomplish legislative ends that they would not be able to do through congressional authorization. And as an example, something as simple as the Volkswagen diesel case. And a large part of that settlement was not money going to the Treasury, but money going to a DOJ/EPA program over $1 billion that Congress had explicitly rejected on multiple occasions in terms of funding some sort of zero emissions vehicle program. And Congress said no in terms of what we want to do on emissions. We want to do different programs, and we're going to refuse the administration's request to fund $500 million for it. And instead, the DOJ and the EPA took that and got Volkswagen to fund it for $1 billion. And those sort of slush fund cases, where in fact the litigators are sort of creating policy different than what Congress wanted without congressional authorization, is something we're looking forward to fighting against. And so we have a petition pending with the Federal Communications Commission where condition a merger between Charter and a number of other cable companies, they required a lot of conditions, regulatory conditions, that had the FCC tried to put those through as part of a rulemaking through the APA process, it never would have stood up. But they're saying, well, we won't agree to this merger and we'll put you through a fight unless you agree to this regulatory program that's completely outside of our authorization and has nothing to do with the sort of competitive concerns that we hypothetically have that would stop the merger. And so current FCC chair and then just FCC board member Ajit Pai had a very interesting dissent flagging the problems that this was creating. And so we took that on behalf of a number of consumers and we challenged it before the FCC, and it'll eventually go to the DC circuit, I imagine. But cabining the regulatory agency there, I think, is very important and something nobody else was doing. How does the Trump administration affect that? Well, it's interesting because for all the complaints that Trump was going to be this new fascist and broad executive power, in fact, the administration sort of unilaterally disarming. We had Jeff Sessions end the DOJ slush fund process of DOJ settling and then funneling money to third-party organizations. So under the Obama administration, you would have these gigantic multi-billion dollar settlements with banks over supposed mortgage problems. And I see I'm running short on time here, but and instead it would get funneled to left-wing groups and then the banks would get credited $2 for every dollar that they would send to the group. And they were assured, please don't send it to the right-wing groups, please don't send it to the Pacific Legal Foundation. That won't happen under the current administration. Now we won't have those settlements at all. So we won't have the opportunity to challenge that in the courts, but unless Congress steps in and permanently regulates that those opportunities will present themselves again. But I agree with Kate that you need to stand by your principles and not just look at the consequentialist aspects. Is it our side that's winning or losing? But look at the larger principles of good governance and the constitutional structure.
So, Mark, is there room for a consequentialist approach?
I was taught at a young age that if you're a lawyer and there's a judge in the room, you should stand when you speak, so I'm going to do that. And before I address the question, I just want to say that as a guy that lives and works in New York City in Midtown Manhattan for 2 decades and went to NYU Law School, I've been at Rock Center for Christmas, I've been in Times Square for New Year's Eve, I've been to several Super Bowls, and I will tell you this. I have never been in a room so crowded with so many people than out there. And I want to say that thank God for that, because I think that the crowd here shows the expansion and the growth of the vast right-wing conspiracy. And I can't think of a better thing for America than that. Well, I'm a professional trial lawyer. I fight to win, that's what I do, and I care about winning more than anything else, as long as it's lawful and ethical. And there's no doubt that the conservative public interest approach based on donors and pro bono is great, but it's extremely limited because there's only so many donors and so many opportunities to pursue our agenda. So my approach is different, and I'd like to submit that you think it through differently. The question is, how can we as conservatives generate more legal attacks on the left, liberal institutions, on greater issues with more plaintiffs and more jurisdictions? And I submit that the way we do this is to actually engage America's Lawsuit, Inc., the plaintiffs bar, as well as the new and growing areas and industry of litigation finance. Now, let's start by talking about how do we use America's lawsuit industry to our advantage? Now look, I'm a longtime conservative, okay? We all generally view the plaintiff's bar as political enemies, right? We view them as political liberals who bring frivolous lawsuits and impose unnecessary litigation taxes on all of us in society. And the truth is, those criticisms are absolutely valid. There are too many lawyers, there are too many lawsuits, there are too many laws and regulations, and the consequence of this, of course, is that the U.S. ship capitalism is weighed down by all these barnacles. But like it or not, the reality is that America's litigation industry is here to stay. The lawsuit industry in America is wealthy, they're politically influential, and they're going nowhere. This is our reality. Yet, though this is our reality, I think that really their existence is no different than some other natural elements such as rain, wind, and sun. While these are powerful forces that can be dangerous to people and to property, I think they can also be harnessed for positive purposes for the conservative movement in America. So the question is, can we conservatives find ways to use the plaintiff's bar and people that sue for a living to our advantage? My answer is unequivocally yes. And to answer this question, I would like to pay homage to the notorious RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, to go outside of the United States briefly to make my legal point here in America. Specifically, I want to go south of the border to the Amazon River, where we find that very famous fish called the piranha. Now, piranha live in schools. In fact, actually, I think they're homeschooled, but I digress. Piranha live in schools, and they have razor-like teeth that tear flesh from their prey as they eat it. Piranhas have been known and reported to eat fish, cows, and yes, even humans. But I think there's something particularly apposite about the piranha in today's panel discussion. You see, piranha are cannibals. They will eat other piranha if they can get away with it. And usually, piranha will eat other piranha when the other piranha is in distress and vulnerable. And this usually occurs when the piranha, by the way, is hooked on a line of a local fisherman, and then all the other piranhas get together and they eat their buddy before the fisherman can pull them into the boat. Now, remarkably, the species here in the United States that most resembles the piranha is the American trial lawyer. And just like the piranha, the trial bar in the United States is more than happy to eat its own if there is money to be made in doing so. Don't believe me? Well, let us spend exactly 10 seconds looking at the newspaper now and realize that prominent liberal lawyers, as we speak, including none other than, I believe, Gloria Allred, are suing the liberal god of Hollywood, Harvey Weinstein, for money over allegations of sexual misconduct. There are currently lawsuits by trial lawyers against CNN, the Clinton News Network, and the New York Times for discrimination. And these are just a handful of examples that you can find in the papers on a daily basis. But why would these sort of generally liberal lawyers who do liberal things that conservative groups tend to criticize, why are they suing? Come on, it's simple. They want to make money, right? Make money. So the lesson that I want to convey today is that if we show any lawyers, including liberal lawyers, plaintiff's lawyers, a pot of gold and how to get them to that end of that rainbow, then voila, guess what? We have them hooked. And this is because their industry, like every other industry, is always looking for new opportunities and markets to exploit. So as conservatives, I think we should begin to look for reasons and explanations for plaintiff's lawyers, frankly, to sue on our behalf. Not because they like us, not because they're members of the Federalist Society, but because they want to make money. On a related note, I just want to say that there's a sort of sister arrangement here that we should consider tapping into, and that's the litigation finance industry. The best example of this, of course, is a situation where, you know, Ted references that you need donor dollars. You don't need donor dollars if people are willing to spend money and invest in lawsuits because they can make a profit. Those effectively become your donors, even though they're not donors, they're investors. And the best example of how an apolitical lawsuit brought against liberal organizations can do good for us is, I think, the Peter Thiel financer, in part, of the lawsuit by Hulk Hogan against Gawker. So Gawker was generally viewed as kind of a liberal, you know, website and whatnot, and it no longer exists in the same way it did because Hulk Hogan, with litigation finance help apparently, basically destroyed it. Again, an advance for the conservative movement, even though the motive was all about money. So how can we deploy the plaintiff's bar in litigation finance to win for conservatives? I don't have all the answers to this, but I'm going to give you a couple examples of what I've thought of. And you can all come up with yours, and that's what I'm encouraging you to do in your localities. So the first one I call is Operation Safe Space. This is a potential profit center that identifies those individuals that have worked at liberal and politically correct companies and perhaps have been discriminated against in their employment. So for example, people under certain New York civil rights laws, if your employer discriminates against you because of your political affiliations outside of the workplace, you have potential civil rights lawsuits. A second potential profit center is what I call Operation Trump Cakes. This effort would involve deploying civil rights testers into liberal hotbeds like San Francisco and Greenwich Village in New York, among other places, and ask that cakes be made to say things like Christians for Trump, gays for Trump, African Americans for Trump, and women for Trump. And let's just see if those businesses and those customized product companies will make those cakes or products. And if they won't, then you may very well have a lawsuit for discrimination like we see before the Supreme Court on the Christian bakers. The third profit center is Operation Economic Geek. For those of you at George Mason, this bud's for you. Operation Economic Geek basically takes advantage of the fact that most local governments are broke. And as a consequence of being broke, they use user fees as illegal taxes. A user fee can be charged by government for it, assuming that the fee is comparable to the cost of providing the services. So if you go to the local town, if you go to the town and they charge you $50 to record a mortgage, that's fine. But the reality is, if they charge you like $1,000 to record the mortgage when it only costs them $50, that's not a user fee, that's an illegal tax. And you can sue and make money for you, and yes, indeed, for the plaintiff's lawyer that sues. The next example is what I call Operation Loony Liberal. Now, this is really simple. You identify a prominent liberal and find a way to sue them, a la Harvey Weinstein. Now, how do you do this? You say, hey, Mark, how do I do this? I mean, I live in Montana and whatnot. How do I do it? I'm going to give you a simple way to think about it, okay? Because I don't believe in donors. I believe in going out there and doing it yourself and winning for yourself, okay? I don't like to be held back by third parties. Go win because it's right and it helps you. Okay, go to Google. Google the name of a local liberal organization or a local liberal and put it in the same sentence as unpaid intern. You may find out that the local liberal organization down the street from you has been using unpaid interns. And as we all know, under the Obama administration's the current interpretation of labor law, basically throughout the United States, if you've used unpaid interns in the last many years, that is illegal. They were supposed to be employees. You can sue, you can make money, get attorney's fees, and again, that's awesome. So find that kid in your local community, add the class action complaint, and stir, and voila, instant money from the left. And my last example before I close, Your Honor, is you guys have been reading about this Missouri Attorney General, and you know, the Missouri Attorney General is investigating Google out there. Now, I don't, you know, he's investigating Google's practices and how to use privacy information, how to use data and all this stuff. I don't know a lot about it, but here's the question I have to conservatives. So I seem to recall when the Attorney General several years ago decided to go after and investigate the tobacco industries, the entire plaintiff's bar in America jumped on and made money. Why are conservative groups not doing that in Missouri right now? Just a question. So to close, the people that prepared this excellent lunch today for the Federalist Society were not motivated to do so because they're concerned for us or our well-being. They served this lunch today because they were getting paid for the services. And just like Adam Smith explained in 1776 in The Wealth of Nations, we rely on the baker, the butcher, and the brewer for our dinner, not from their benevolence, but for their self-interest. So likewise, I urge all conservatives in the conservative political movement and otherwise to look for finding opportunities for Lawsuit Inc. to sue in effect for conservatives, not because it's good for conservatives, but because it's good for the people suing and good for the lawyers. And then, as these lawsuits are prosecuted, we on the right and in the conservative public interest legal movement can also begin to experience what I like to call better living through litigation. Thank you.
Wow. Professor Grieva, we haven't actually ever defined conservative litigation. Is conservative litigation about making money for conservatives vis-a-vis other people in society? Or is conservative litigation about promoting smaller government? Is conservative litigation about promoting deregulation? And making sure that lawyers are not enriched at the off on the backs of the plaintiffs who might be more deserving.